Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Transfigured. This is Brendan Graham Dempsey. You are the director of the Sky Meadow Institute, which we can talk about what that is in a minute. You are also an author and a podcast host, and you focus on metamodern Christianity and spirituality and religion. And I feel like you're sort of a recent new member of this little corner of the internet, or recently been exposed to us and have been talking with a bunch of us. So I'm excited to talk to you more today. I think we're going to talk about your story a little bit, but probably not the full thing. If you want a much fuller treatment of Brendan's story, I will point you to Paul Vanderclay's recent conversation with him. I'll include a link to that in the description. But Brendan, do you want to introduce yourself and then talk a little bit kind of specifically about sort of your faith background? Because I think you and I have a lot of similarities, and then sort of talk about, you know, what you're up to now.
Sure. Yeah. And thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I've seen you talking to a number of folks in this little corner and having some awesome conversations with folks like Paul Anleitner, and you seem to be sort of in the center of things as sort of a hub. So yeah, I'm a recent I'm not sure if I don't know if I'd be seen as a member yet. I don't know what kind of initiation process there might be for that, but I'm certainly.
Oh, you'll find out soon enough.
Yeah.
you expect to get kidnapped and have a hood thrown over your head sometime in the near future.
I'm excited for that, but I've recently started to engage with a lot of folks in this corner for reasons relating to my kind of work in metamodern spirituality and the topic of metamodernism and its relationship to meaning and purpose and religion and that sort of a thing, and with sort of folks like Paul Vanderclay and Paul Anleitner and others, you know, exploring metamodernism as a topic and then trying to sort of conceptualize how that relates to Christianity. That's when I started becoming really aware of what was happening in this space. And obviously there's a lot of overlap with some of the figures who are engaged, you know, John Vervaeke most notably, but you know, the kinds of then conversations John Vervaeke has had with, you know, folks like Peugeot and Vanderclay, and Jordan Hall is another who I recently interviewed on my podcast about his conversion. So,
Has that come out yet?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's, was sort of the foray into this actually. Cause that kind of, brought me, sort of into contact with a number of folks who saw that. And yeah. So, my work is mainly in that vein, and I'm now excited about the kind of dialogue that's unfolding about what this means. And I have, you know, my own notions of it, but other people are bringing their conceptions. So it's a very fertile discourse at the moment. And I feel like this will be an extension of and a further exploration of those issues. So that's kind of how I'd position myself. And yeah, in terms of my story and my background, as you mentioned, I get into that in detail with PVK. But the short version is I grew up in a very kind of conservative evangelical charismatic tradition, and in northern Vermont, well, in Milton, Vermont, and was sort of introduced to the perspective of very much that kind of dispensational kind of Christianity, end times framed Christianity. Not that was the sole kind of, there wasn't like apocalyptic fervor or anything, you know, growing up, but it was definitely kind of the context in which, you know, faith unfolded, let's say. So when you memorized Bible verses, it was with the understanding that, well, the Antichrist is probably going to be showing up pretty soon. And when you do, and you get thrown in prison, you'll want to have those on hand to, you know, and this, that sort of mentality, which, you know, is a little bit, it's a lot to lay on kids when you're growing up.
Did you read the Left Behind books as a kid?
I did. I read the first one. Didn't like, you know, go through the whole series necessarily, but it was very much, that was sort of very much in the air. And you know, I went to on and off, I went to a very kind of conservative evangelical school where, you know, we had like the Abeka curriculum that, like, you know, didn't teach evolution and taught that that wasn't real and all this stuff. So kind of a very insular, you know, upbringing in that particular tradition. And
You said your parents had been sort of part of the Jesus movement or some of the groups coming out of that. Am I remembering that correctly?
yeah, they grew up in kind of mainline, you know, sort of Lutheran and Episcopal churches, but then in the 70s with you know, all of that swept in, they it became very personal for them, and they converted to born again Christianity, and yeah, so that was sort of their foray, and then ended in, you know, I grew up in an Assemblies of God church, which yeah, has that kind of charismatic Pentecostal sort of orientation to it, yeah, and then so as I got older, you know, eventually I kind of moved from the faith being sort of the water that I swam in as sort of the unquestioned background context into a kind of more conscious awareness of it and interest in it, and got very actively personally involved, you know, in kind of early teenage years, and converted, got baptized, reading my Bible a lot, and decided that I should either be a pastor or someone who taught biblical studies at like a Christian seminary. It was sort of my
Sure.
trajectory.
Vermont is not necessarily the Bible Belt.
No, it's not.
So I mean, we were talking a little bit before the mic was on that I went to school at Cornell in upstate New York, which is pretty similar to Vermont, although we also both agreed that Vermont is still has its own unique flair, even if Ithaca and Burlington are about as similar as any two cities have to each other. But I presume that going to a church and taking your faith seriously was pretty unique among kids in your area. And that even if you went to a Christian school, you were still pretty aware that you were doing something quite unique that set you apart from most of the people around you.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it's hard to know, you know, when you go back and you think about your perspective at that time, it's hard to kind of conceptualize how conscious you are of those sorts of dynamics. But certainly the older that I got, the more clear it became that this was, yeah, marked me and my family and our community out as sort of being, you know, doing something different, certainly than most people. And in the, and you know, that kind of lends itself also to a kind of radicalization as well. I mean, there was a moment in my life when I was sort of hardcore into the notion that, like, you know, yeah, these kind of, we live in a fallen world, and basically these, you know, godless heathen liberals are destroying everything, and you know, like, that's just the orientation, you know, and of course there are political orientations to that, or inflections of that too. So, you know, this was a relatively brief moment, but there was a period when, like, I was listening to Sean Hannity 3 hours a day, reading his books, really deep into kind of that nexus of like political conservatism and evangelicalism, you know, probably only lasted 6 months to a year or so, but still there was definitely a moment in my arc that included that, which I mentioned that just because there's a kind of ideological framing of sort of like, you know, us against the world, and the world being, you know, like, yeah, I think that the mentality of we live in a liberal world, or a world that has sort of like left the church, left the you know, insights of the Christian message, and therefore is leading to all sorts of sort of degeneration and backwardness and that sort of a thing. And so, you know, in the kind of faith community I was a part of, we conceptualized ourselves as being, you know, holding to the true course and the narrow way and all that sort of a thing. And then in that context, of course, a message like, you know, the sheep and the goats and the apocalypse takes on a very profound, you know, sense to it when you're like, oh gosh, pretty much 90% of the other people I know in the world are, you know, destined for hellfire, I suppose, come the final trumpet.
I think that there is something kind of that there's a often a shared ingredient of people in this little corner that not a lot of them are from places that are heavily Christian growing up, even if they had a Christian background. I mean, obviously there are exceptions. I know, there's people from Texas and Arkansas and more kind of typically Bible belty kind of places, but a lot of people in this little corner of the internet were Christian in a place that it was unusual to be Christian. And had a very strong exposure to secular, liberal, or progressive culture, either where they grew up or in college or afterwards or something like that. And even Paul Vanderclay himself is sort of a you know, Sacramento, California is not exactly the Bible Belt either. Right. And, you know, he growing up doing an inner city church in Paterson, New Jersey and stuff like that. So often I feel like there part of what a lot of people in this group share is trying to reconcile faith with an extremely secular environment.
Yeah.
And I think that is part of some of the ingredients of what's going on in metamodern Christianity.
Yeah. And I think that there's a reason why I think there's probably as much openness in this space, you know, and I'm sure that that has its own spectrum to it in different, you know, different folks, different podcasts and that sort of a thing. But like your channel is a good example of that. I think of, as you talk about in your sort of description of for your podcast, that video, it's sort of like Christians, non-Christians, just as long as you have something interesting and important to offer into this conversation, that's a value. And that's certainly not the norm, let's say, in all religious contexts, you know, quite the opposite often, if not normally. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that. And there's therefore a reason why I'm showing up, you know, and engaging with this space in as productive a way as I feel like, you know, we're experiencing, because of that openness. So that's a good thing. And yeah, people can probably assess me on where I fall into any of that spectrum and based on my experience, but yeah, I can definitely see that.
So tell us a little bit more about the Sky Meadow Institute and sort of what you're up to now.
So Sky Meadow Institute is something I launched at the end of last year. I run a retreat center here in Vermont called Sky Meadow Retreat. And that's, we are like an event space, place for people to come and do gatherings of various kinds, you know, retreats, obviously, mainly, but we do various sorts of things. But I am involved intensely with this meta-modern conversation space and community that's arisen in a big way over the past, you know, 4 to 5 years. And so as more and more of that was starting to cohere into like a real community, and there seemed to be a kind of, a sort of integrity to the vision and the sort of scope and the kinds of, you know, perspectives that were involved and the kinds of things people were interested in doing, it seemed like it would be really important for us to kind of have a shared space where we could do those things together, because it's an online community primarily, and it's sort of almost a kind of global diaspora of people all over the place. So it's very hard to find that kind of in-person, in real life connection. And it's very meaningful and profound when you can kind of come together with those folks that you found scattered all over the place and have that in-person experience. So Sky Meadow Institute is really sort of a focused sort of organization trying to bring folks in that community and exploring those kinds of topics to this place to do certain kinds of things. That'd be one way of characterizing it. I mean, in its more broad sense, I think I came up with the tagline that Sky Meadow Institute is like an organization dedicated to promoting systems-based thinking about the things that matter most, which is to say applying lenses around complexity and systems thinking to issues of meaning and the stuff that matters the most in life, like, you know, what do we eat and where does our food come from? What sort of jobs and work are we doing? What sort of political systems and educational systems do we have? But most importantly, what sort of like meaning-making structures like religions and ideologies exist, and how can we sort of help develop those into the direction of a more kind of holistic, systemically oriented, complexity-informed kind of direction? So that's kind of more the kind of, you know, boilerplate response, but you know, in the end, it's really trying to just bring people together to do this sort of work in person and have a place to do that is what that's about. So that's really the heart of what I'm up to at the moment. I mean, I'm doing a lot of things sort of under that umbrella. You know, we're doing these retreats or these metamodern spirituality labs that happen twice a year. I'm working on many books. I'm always kind of writing something. I'm currently writing a book called The Evolution of Meaning, which is trying to basically lay all this out in a way that people can digest in kind of a, you know, a big, it'll be kind of a, I don't know, a tome of sorts. It's probably going to be around 1,000 pages, but I want to kind of just lay out my conception of like what this all means from kind of information theoretical terms up into the evolution of sort of human justification systems and how meaning and value and stuff develops through that. So that's kind of something.
Well, it sounds a little ambitious.
Yeah. I've got a lot of, I don't know what the metaphor would be. I've got a lot of balls in the air. I've got a lot of, there's a lot of pots or something. But anyway, and then of course, I also podcast. I have a Metamodern Spirituality podcast. And I'm really just trying to cultivate this emerging discourse that is unfolding where people have an appreciation for this new paradigm of emergence and complexity and systems thought and integration of different perspectives into a metamodern lens. So all that sort of, you know, in some ways captured by the term metamodernism in my mind. And a lot of that's influenced by things like integral theory and the Bildung movement and other folks who have come into this space trying to do things, exploring postmodern systematic philosophies and things like that. And yeah, I'm just throwing everything in the kitchen sink at trying to bring this
throwing
stuff
all
to
the
world.
Pots in the kitchen sink
all
at
the
same
all the
way
pots in the kitchen sink, the whole kitchen's going in. But I think it's really vital, as many folks, you know, will know, especially if they're tracking Verveke's work and the folks he talks to, even Jordan Hall and others talk about the meta crisis that we're experiencing and how that ties into the meaning crisis. And so that's been my preoccupation since my own personal meaning crisis, you know, like however many years ago. And so I feel like we're experiencing that sort of collectively. And I feel like there is a way through and beyond it. And I think if we can orient ourselves to that, it's the best hope we've got to trying to, you know, see a flourishing, sustainable future. And yeah, I'm sure I'll have more to say about this in a second, but there are other orientations that become possible and attractive options in that same situation that can ultimately, from my perspective, be like regressive ones where people will see this chaos, the meaning crisis, and want to find something more comfortable or familiar, which I don't think will give us all the tools that we need to make sense of things optimally. And then, you know, then we're in trouble. So that's a big reason why I'm trying so hard to communicate as best as I can and as limited in an imperfect way, granted, but as best as I can, how I'm conceiving of how Christianity can continue to develop and move through these different modes and perspectives and insights into something that I think is flourishing and sustainable into the future.
All right. So we've said this word metamodern a couple times now. I think let's try and define what exactly we think that is. And I mean, I think it's still kind of being ironed out, but we can maybe talk about modernism, postmodernism, and then what that means for metamodernism as well.
Sure. And up front, I'll just mention here, if you can see these books here, I wrote a book called Metamodernism or The Cultural Logic of Cultural Logics, where I kind of lay out my synthetic vision of what all this means. So if people are interested in getting like a kind of, you know, clear programmatic book form of all this, they could check that out if they're interested. So metamodernism refers to an attempt to articulate a postmodern perspective, which is to say a perspective that somehow moves through and beyond postmodernism, but also by means of postmodernism, by incorporating the insights such as they are of postmodernism. And so to the degree that we have experienced this sort of evolution of paradigms or worldviews or whatever you want to call them, you know, from modernism to postmodernism, well, you could even say from the pre-modern to the modern to the postmodern. Now there's this question of, okay, well, if the postmodern has sort of, you know, dissipated, if that's in some ways in the rearview mirror, where are we now and what do we make sense of this new moment that we're in and the new ways that people are thinking in such a way that somehow is on the other side of postmodernism? So there are many ways to get at that question and what that looks like. One of those ways is, as you say, to kind of lay out what do we mean by modernism and then what do we mean by postmodernism? And I can do that if you feel like that would be sort of the sure.
Yeah, I think that would be valuable.
Great. Yeah. So modernism in the sense that, I'll use it isn't just like modernism in the arts. It's more like modernity. And I think people will have a better sense of that. So we can think of modern to postmodern, to metamodern here. So by the modern, what do we mean? Well, the modern as a kind of paradigm or worldview or episteme, as it's called, shows up in this period that is sort of that begins in many ways with, you know, the Renaissance and leads into the Enlightenment and then from there to the Industrial Revolution and so on. It is in many ways a self-conscious reflection on what had been before and the sort of critique of what had been before and the recognition that we were now in a new orientation towards issues of truth and understanding values and that sort of a thing. And in a manner that, sort of precipitated a worldview shift. So here, of course, if you're going to define the modern, unfortunately, you've got to throw in another perspective as well to understand that, because you have to understand what the modern in some ways was defining itself against. And that you could call the pre-modern, you could call it the traditional, different language could be used for this. But basically, if you want to imagine that split that occurs, you know, from the medieval period, where let's just focus on Europe for now, though this can be expanded cross-culturally in many ways as well, though that becomes a bit more of a complicated conversation. But in the European context, right, you've got kind of the Middle Ages dominated by religion and tradition and scholasticism and a certain kind of, you know, orientation and understanding of reality that, you know, roots things in divine causes. And I think folks who have, you know, done some history will have a sense of that kind of ethos and that worldview that exists. And from that, you know, there emerges, you know, and people can date these at different points, but a different conception that starts to rely on things like more on things like empirical evidence and argumentation, the nascent scientific method. You know, you get people like Bacon and Galileo showing up, and then that leading to Newton and this sort of rising notion that the world can be understood and sort of mapped and measured in a way that didn't exist in the pre-modern world. You know, this really gets going by the time you're in the 1600s and into the 1700s, and people start applying this sort of like measured mathematical mechanistic approach to reality in ways that kind of unlock all this sort of power and potential in kind of human culture and civilization, in the sense of we generate all these new technologies, you know, then the steam engine and, well, before that, you know, water wheels and things. And you get this slow but kind of accelerating technological increase rooted in this sort of new perspective. And eventually, yeah, this leads to a kind of runaway cultural transformation, which winds up shifting people's perspectives on reality. So that if you were to compare, you know, a sort of thoughtful, maybe more intellectually inclined person in, say, you know, 1750 to someone in 1350, you're talking about the difference of the modern thinker is going to, well, let's start, you know, the let's say the traditional or the pre-modern thinker is going to look at the world and say, there's a creator God. That God's revealed in the scriptures. You know, we can use our understanding to better get closer to that deity, but ultimately it's sort of, you know, like faith seeking understanding. In that sense, it's not understanding kind of as it being in the driver's seat, you could say. There's a great reliance on tradition. There's a belief in sort of correspondences in nature, that sort of everything has a kind of innate intrinsic purpose to it because it was created by a, you know, willing, intentional, purposeful God. And that there is this divine drama that the human being is a part of that is rooted in sort of sacred history, where, you know, God created the world, there was a fall, and now there's going to be a kind of end to that situation and the making of a new heaven, new earth. So there's this whole kind of cosmic story and sacred history that's involved in all of that. There's sort of, in its sort of more developed form, a great chain of being that sort of links everything together in this grand hierarchy, and everything in the social order somehow has this sort of natural place. And so that's just sort of like a summary of what that perspective looks like in, say, 1350. Over in 1750, it's profoundly shifted. And there is now this issue of, well, there are natural causes and there are mechanistic forces and there are whether there's a God is now open to debate, and people are openly discussing that. Whereas before, in this pre-modern context, if you even suggested as much, you'd be deemed a heretic and probably burned alive. But people are now able to explore these topics and consider the mechanistic causes that seem to underlie forces. They can see that things are mathematically in relationship to each other in a causal way that can be sort of deduced, and the worldview then is one of a mechanistic kind of clock-like universe where maybe there was a God who got it started, but for the most part, now things are just sort of running like gears or cogs, you know? And that the human being is essentially a kind of machine, you know, with a bunch of things that kind of are all working together. And when you look in the world, you don't see a natural order or hierarchy. That's a kind of false way of looking at it. Actually, you see things that are subject to change and even maybe should be changed in the same way that like technology has revolutionized culture. Maybe we can change our societies and the way that we rule and govern ourselves. And so you get the development of democracy instead of like natural divine law, and monarchy and whatnot. And you know, universal human rights start showing up, and you get religious pluralism and these sorts of things. So that's a very different conception of reality. You could imagine these as being kind of profoundly opposed worldviews, or opposed might be too strong, but certainly different, right? And so and the modern is sort of reflecting on the pre-modern, what has been, and sort of saying, no, we're in a new place now. We've moved away from that older way of thinking, that childish form of thinking, and now we have reason and rationality and all of that. And we are on a march towards progress, basically. You know, we're clearly changing ourselves in the world we're living in, and quality of life is increasing, and we have new technologies and all these things, and learning more and more. And that's the story now. It's not so much a sacred history; it's more a natural evolving progression towards better and better futures. And the best stuff is in. The best is yet to come, you know. The best stuff is whatever we set our minds to, and that sort of thing. So that's sort of the modern as it defines itself against sort of the pre-modern traditional. So that kind of is in vogue for a long time. You know, the modern, you know, period, you could say, or modernity, if it does kind of really get going in a big way, 14, 1500s, 1600s, you know, really kind of reaches a sort of you know, flourishing in the 19th century and the early 20th century. And what really kind of interrupts that narrative in a profound way are the cataclysms of World Wars One and Two, which just totally shift the whole kind of geopolitical and kind of ideological landscape. Because after the rubble kind of And the after you after the smokes, you could say, settles from World War II in the mid 20th century, people kind of reflect and they're like, hey, wait a second, that was pretty awful, and pretty much the worst thing ever. What about progress? What was that all about? It seems our technology just led us to invent things like the atom bomb. It seems like you know, our move away from religion just led us to the invention of new kinds of religions, of racism and communism and fascism and all this stuff. You know, what's going on here? And in the years following that kind of post-war reflection, you get a lot of critique and response to the modern perspective in a way that really problematizes that whole narrative. And this is sort of the beginning of postmodern thought, I think, at least in terms of its flourishing. You can see earlier signs of this at various points, but
Who would you say are some of the earlier signs?
well, I mean, you could go back into like the okay, so some of the early modernist artists, what we call modernists, Hansi Freinach makes a good point, I think, and I think this is rather insightful actually, that a lot of what's going on there is actually probably better understood as sort of proto-postmodernism, meaning if you look at the early impressionists, on into the expressionists and the dadaists especially, right? So much of what's happening there is this turn towards perspective, turn towards the recognition that everyone is coming from a particular lens on things, and we can now sort of explore that lens. So here are the the relativism and the perspectivalism that gets introduced with postmodernism is already really beginning to be explored in its nascent forms. You know, like if you read a Virginia Woolf novel, you know, like what Miss Dalloway or whatever, she'll kind of go in and out of the different like modes of perception of her different speakers or her different characters, in a way that shows that there's an inside to everyone, and they're like the sort of quote unquote omniscient third person perspective, what Paul would probably call the monarchical vision, right? That there is no view from nowhere. It's always a view from somewhere.
And would you say that modernism was very much getting at that absolute truth, the view from nowhere,
exactly.
The base level reality of things, often inspired by the success of physics that seemingly was trying to do that and yielding very powerful results?
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the Enlightenment hope, was that, hey, wow, we've left behind our, you know, parochial religious warring and confusion, superstition and dogma, and now we've discovered reason and rationality. And everyone, hypothetically, has access to that same universal reason. And so now we can reorient our whole human project along this universal phenomenon and come to the ultimate single right answer for everything, essentially. And that's essentially what the postmodernists come along and say, no, you can't. Because
Like we're going to put the past to the test, and we're going to, either through scientific methods or things mimicking the scientific method, we're going to do this verification thing where you go through the exercise of kind of taking yourself out of the picture. Is kind of part of the scientific method,
or
at least trying to average together or synthesize together a lot of different perspectives to kind of get rid of bias or individuality, to get at the absolute foundation of things. And again, this seems to work relatively well for physics, but the further you get away from that, it's like, well, can we do that for sociology? Can we do that for, okay, it's like we can kind of still do some scientific experiments maybe in sociology. Okay, well, but what about history? Okay, what about theology? What about, and we'll talk about biblical criticism. All right, and can we do that with ethics? You know, like Kant trying to do some like empirical, you know, from first principles, logically, you know, irrefutable deduction of morality, and, you know, all these sorts of things. And like the further away you get from its original use case, the less well it seems to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And one of the things I'm really excited about in metamodernism, which we'll come back to, is a lot of these questions and issues find a new framing in that context that I think actually much more successfully than any of the previous paradigms is able to navigate those issues and begin to explain why that all that stuff is the case, if that makes sense. Like, why can we do things with physics that we can't do with sociology, you know, and all of that. So we can come back to that. And a big part of that is complexity, and all. And,
I'll just say something kind of briefly. I sometimes wonder if the statisticians deserve more credit in having discovered problems with modernity and leading into postmodernity. Like in statistics, there's this big debate between what's called the frequentists and the Bayesians. And I'll try and make this not too boring, but basically, a frequentist is kind of modern in their approach to statistics, in that there is an appropriate statistical test for every experiment, and it will yield, you know, the absolute right results, and that everyone should be applying the same statistical methods and the same statistical tests. And the Bayesians come along and are like, well, you know, actually, you can do statistics better if you use prior probabilities, but the problem is that you don't know how to pick your prior probabilities, but you can often shortcut and get more interesting and more practically useful results, but you have to assume some prior knowledge.
Yeah.
And so if you can bring some assumptions to bear on the problem, it actually sometimes makes some problems easier and quicker to solve in statistics.
Yeah.
But then the questions are, well, what prior probabilities, what prior knowledge are you bringing to this question?
Yeah, yeah.
And it is bringing in the first person perspective again.
Right.
And the frequentists are often like modernists are like, no, you can't do that. It's subjective. It's, you know, unverifiable. It's like, why are you assuming that and not that? There's an infinite number of things you can assume. And the Bayesians are like, there are an infinite number of things you can assume, but you have to assume something. And even you frequentists are actually assuming something.
You're
actually just a subset of Bayesian statistics
that
just has a certain prior probability distribution. And then the frequentists are like, shoot. Right. And it's that is in many different fields. I feel like the postmodern problem. I feel like the statisticians got there in like the mid 1800s.
I love that. That's a great way of framing some of that. And there's so much you could say about all of that. I mean, folks who hear something like that, I think hopefully immediately think, hey, that sounds a lot like stuff that relates to John Vervaeke talking about relevance realization. And I, you know, and I could say more about that. But it's also really interesting because, right, if at the end of the day, the Bayesians are able to, let's say, do work in a way that has a kind of higher success rate and a kind of and leads to sort of a greater causal power, you could say, from those insights, then that's an advance of science. Right. Because like, you know, if in many ways you want to justify a scientific framework by, you know, how well can it, if not predict things, at least, you know, yield utilizable gains that we can then generate. And, you know, like think, well, so much can be said about this. This leads us into the philosophy of science and all this stuff. But like, we don't fully even understand quantum mechanics, but we know that we can use it in all of our communication devices and things like that. So like there's a certain kind of truth that we can feel comfortable in, even though we don't fully understand all that's going on, when we're able to utilize a particular theory or framework in a way that sort of is reliably accurate and yields kind of reliable phenomena. So if the Bayesians are more reliable in the stuff that they're able to do, let's just say in any given instance, then you could view that as like confirmation of that orientation. And interestingly, that means it's sort of more scientific than what the scientists were doing, but it's more scientific by being able to bring in, as you say, some of the contextuality and the relativity and the sort of first person angle to all of that. And so this is a way of imagining that progression from the modern into the postmodern as being the genuine insights, because in some instances, the postmodern insights are able to do better science than the modern scientists are able to do, because they're taking in more, you know, scientific variables and information. And so
like a specific example of that is that Bayesian statisticians have like clinical trials have been one of the main uses of statistics, right? We were talking about you do some editing for a scientific journal. I've, you know, published various papers in scientific journals often in like as a medical statistician. And what's interesting is when you're, say, doing a trial to try and determine if this new cancer drug will be effective, you want to need as few people as possible in your trial to get to the answer as quickly as you can. Because the more people you have to test on, there's literally life and death that you're not wasting, but having to, you know, invest as part of your trial to get to the answer. And so you want to need as few people. And a Bayesian design trial can often get to an answer faster than a frequentist design trial. But what's interesting, and this is where I feel like things are starting to unravel, is that you, if you're a good Bayesian statistician, you can also design a trial to be more likely to get the answer that you want. And so if you're a pharmaceutical company that really wants your drug to get approved, then you can start to manipulate the trial and manipulate, I'm not, maybe that's the right word, manipulate the trial design to get an answer that you want, but it might not be the right answer. But then what do we mean by the right answer? And then all of a sudden that whole framework starts to seem like we used to be like, all right, it passed the scientific trial, the drug works, put it on the shelves in the pharmacy, have doctors start prescribing it, get it out there. And it's like, or the drug failed, never mind, throw it into the ash heap of history, you know, start a new drug trial. Even that distinction is like starting to break down and get fuzzy. And I think that during COVID, there was actually a lot of that kind of weird fuzziness of postmodern science starting to and like a modern expectation of what science can give us and a postmodern expectation of what science can give us. It's interesting. Anyway, I don't mean to steal the microphone too much.
No, it's they're great illustrations of these things, and even just including right into the entire frame of reference that there are pharmaceutical companies that they fund the research and therefore they have an interest that, you know, like this research isn't just coming from nowhere to, you know, it's like, so that realization is a part of the postmodern recognition that, again, if you take that very seriously and you do this with integrity, that kind of insight can lead us to the point where we can be doing better science, because we can then ask those questions like, well, how do we avoid just, you know, basically setting up the test to get the results that we want? And how do we, you know, you can use that frame that you've now got to try to get beyond that frame and try to actually be, you know, asking those questions, which you couldn't ask before you even were aware that those were issues.
It's sort of like the postmodern insight is that all trials are designed in such a way to maximize the probability that you get what you want. The question then is, what should you want to get?
Yes, yes.
If you're a pharmaceutical company, you want to be as darn sure that your drug will get approved. If you're a patient, you want to be as sure that when you're taking a medicine, it's going to get you the medical outcome that you want.
Okay, so this is great. Yeah.
If you're a public health agency, you might have something slightly different than the individual,
right?
Because you want herd immunity, but the individual doesn't want to take a vaccine or a drug that might have individual risk on them that's different than the concerns of the herd immunity of the population, and that's different than the concerns of Pfizer, and that's different than the concerns of certain kinds of countries, and like, you know, all of a sudden, you have to have something that you want in order to design the trial properly. Yeah. And then what do you want?
This is it. This is huge. And this is a great way to help explain what metamodernism is about, because you can see then how that postmodern insight explodes into this relativistic frame. It's sort of like truth from whose perspective, or the outcome, as you say, there has to be something that you value in order to assess what you're looking at, right? And then it's like, well, who values what? And then you just get this sort of mass frame of a bunch of these different perspectives. And the postmodern answer to that was sort of, that's the way it is. And there is no, because there's no God's eye view, there's no one to adjudicate any of that. Everything's just a matter of perspectives. And they often then overlaid this with the sense of, well, what's really going to happen is the people with power are going to get their perspective imposed, because those are the perspectives that have the sort of like clout to force their perspectives on others. And there's a lot of truth to that as well. But what then the metamodernists come around and say is precisely this, that one, this has opened up a problem space that obviously needs to be ideally found a solution to, or that we can move through this insight to a way that can regain some coherence to that radical plurality, that we're not just living in a dissociative, you know, fragmented, you know, myriad of micro narratives, right? So how do we try to bring some coherence and consilience to this range of possible perspectives? And that's what metamodernism tries to do. Someone in the TLC responded, it might've been Christian Baxter, to someone asking what's metamodernism about, and I think they said something like, metamodernism is trying to take, you know, the insights of modernism and postmodernism and set them in a hierarchy of value, and I think that that's a good way of thinking about it, right? So what the metamodern brings to the conversation after the postmodern insight is that we can set these different frames within a hierarchy of value. And as you were saying, we need values to be able to adjudicate, you know, cui bono, for who's good, in order to make sense of these sorts of things. Absent that, we live in a totally fragmented universe of possible perspectives, but no way to sort of orient between them. So metamodernism is post-postmodern in that it moves through the postmodern insight of that pluralization of perspectives, but it's able to organize and coherently, you could say, relate these perspectives one to the other in such a way that we can situate them in a hierarchy of value. And that is the insight, you could say, of the metamodern frame. Now, then you'd have to ask, how do you do that, right? And what's interesting is that one really valuable lens for doing this is by just asking the question, how many lenses are you aware of, right? Like, what lens has access to what number of perspectives? What I mean by that, right, is that like, if you're operating in a perspective where, let's say, you grew up in a particular worldview, and let's say, I don't know, you're born in a particular country where everyone, you know, is mostly this particular religion, and so you hold to that religion, and you see there being this sort of like, you know, cosmology where there's like a dome, and I don't know, there's whatever, right? Let's just, like, that's just what you're enculturated into, and so that's your worldview. Then the scientist can come along and look at that perspective and say, oh, okay, this person was enculturated into this perspective, and they can gain a vantage on that enculturation process from their sort of from their remove in that situation. And then they can start to do this modern thing and study them like a modern anthropologist would, right? But then you can get beyond that frame when the postmodernists come along. It's like, hey, modern anthropologist, you're actually in your own frame, and it's called modernist anthropology, right? And so now you've got a modernist anthropology frame and the person that you're studying of this more pre-modern frame, and that's all it is. It's just frames. Now then,
anthropology is a great example of a field that really kind of struggles with this, because as we sort of mentioned earlier, all right, that objective type of thing maybe works best at physics, but as you get further away from it, it gets difficult.
Right.
Okay, so what if you're trying to have a field of study that is the study of humans? Okay, but who's going to study human groups?
Yeah.
Well, a human group has to study a human group.
Yeah.
Well, can a human group study a human group because it is a human group? Could you be an anthropologist that studies anthropologists, right? You know, and then all of a sudden, right, it like backfires on itself. And then you get sort of the postmodern like kind of critique where it's like, oh, it's just colonial powers trying to understand these subjugated powers, which was kind of true. But then, but are they, is that a bad thing? And then, you know,
No, and so then the metamodern move is to go that next step and say, and it actually is to do precisely what you said, is that we need, what's called the double hermeneutic. This actually arises in sociology, not anthropology, but it's the same issue, right? It's like sociologists start to realize, hey, wait a second. Sociologists are creating knowledge that then people in society believe and see the world through. And so sociologists are actually shaping the worldviews of people. And it's like, well, we need to study that, you know, because...
And we are in the system that we are looking
exactly,
at.
Exactly,
exactly. Yes.
So then you get this appreciation that we need to be able to see how we are forming knowledge as embedded individuals actively shaping the environment that we ourselves are partaking in. And that's a big aspect of the metamodern frame. It's basically like, gaining a meta vantage on... these sorts of things. I call this the triple hermeneutic in a ridiculous way, but that's kind of what we need, because we need then people to be studying the people who are coming up with ideas like the double hermeneutic. To bring this back to Earth for a second, because this might seem to be a bit trippy for people, and they're like, well, what do you do with all this? I think the takeaway, though, is that people who get this sense of profound vertigo or confusion or disorientation from this radical relativism of postmodernism are finding through this metamodern move a way to orient themselves by situating themselves relative to value. And that is a big part of the conversation that's going on, obviously, with folks like John Vervaeke and others, by framing things in transjective terms and all that. But also, to clarify that point I was trying to make a second ago, is that if one can maintain the perspective, let's say, of I'll put it this way, the perspective that can include the maximal number of perspectives should be at the top of our value hierarchy. Okay. Meaning that if you have a different perspective and I can't even begin to cognize it, and all I hear is that you're saying false things and evil things and you should probably be destroyed, and you hear me and you understand, no, I know where you're coming from. Like, I get that. Even maybe I used to believe those things too, but I also see this other thing. Then you're able to have two perspectives instead of one. Right. And then so on and so forth. So that if you can have a perspective on the perspective on the perspective and so forth, this gives you a kind of skeleton key or a way to assess the value of these different perspectives by how much they are able to have reflectively gained on previous perspectives and show where they are basically literally in this kind of value hierarchy. That's one way of putting it. And people are welcome to be like, hey, wait, challenge that. And it's like, yes, let's challenge that. Let's talk about it. Let's debate it. But like, that's one way that the metamodern moves then tries to orient, you know, where we are along this value contingency. And then I can, in a second, try to explain exactly why this is so important for a metamodern Christianity, but I don't want to hog the mic.
Sure. Well, so here, this example might not seem related, but I promise it will be. All right. So this wasn't a project I worked on. I was kind of consulting on this project that a different hospital was working on in my past as a medical statistician, but it's actually extremely related. So let's imagine that you're trying to predict which patients get sepsis. Sepsis is like a bacterial infection when you're in the hospital. Okay, great. That seems like, all right, but you're predicting it. So what? You don't want to just predict it. You want to try and prevent sepsis. Okay, so you have this sepsis model that is predicting which patients are getting sepsis, but it's constantly updating itself with the new information to keep itself up to date. Oh, it starts being used by the nursing staff. They look at the patients most at risk of sepsis, and then they go in and they try and prevent sepsis in those patients. Hmm. But the model doesn't know this. And so after a while, the patients that it originally thought were most at risk of sepsis don't look like they get sepsis anymore. The reason why is because the nurses are looking at the output of the model and intervening to prevent sepsis.
Yeah.
So it starts ignoring those patients and looking at different patients that the nurses weren't looking at. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it thinks those are the patients most at risk of getting sepsis. But suddenly that high risk group is now getting neglected by the nurses and they're starting to get sepsis again. And this other group isn't getting sepsis. But that's because the model isn't taking into account the fact that it is affecting the system at which it is predicting.
Yes. Yes.
And
exactly.
And so, right. But so then how do you do that? Well, you have to incorporate into your prediction what your prediction will affect the system.
Yeah.
So it's like, I am predicting the outcome plus my prediction, plus my prediction's effect on the outcome.
Yep. Yep.
And it's like,
you need a meta prediction. And
you need a meta prediction.
And what's interesting,
and what you realize is that prediction actually isn't what you're trying to do. Hmm. You're trying to affect the system.
Uh-huh.
Because if we think that we're just predictors, like Galileo looking through his telescope, trying to predict the moons around Jupiter. All right. So Galileo's telescope doesn't affect the moons of Jupiter. But your predictive model affects the sepsis system that it's in.
Yeah.
And the closer you get to yourself, right, that's why it works for astronomy better than it works for anthropology. Because if you're an anthropologist, you're inside this group of people.
Yes.
And your measurement is affecting things. And then we get to quantum physics that measuring is the effect. It does cause the thing to actually happen.
Mm.
And so measurement isn't abstract. It's like a action. And then,
Well,
and so theology is starting to realize that, like, I can't just like sit back in my chair and try and figure out who God is, because I'm in the image of God. And like anyway.
Well, I would say everything that you were just talking about there with, you know, the prediction being needing to be predicted, and then, you know, we're in the systems that we're affecting and all that stuff. That is where you start getting the insights of things like cybernetics, right? And complexity science and systems thinking, right? So when I was talking about Sky Meadow Institute, what we're trying to do is bring a systems thinking to issues of meaning and what matters, because we need to appreciate the kinds of dynamics that you're describing. Now, what's interesting is the modern lens doesn't see those things. It thinks that it doesn't take itself into account. And so it thinks that we can just sort of have this linear relationship. But when you start appreciating the dynamics that we're talking about, you see that there are nonlinear dynamics that get these feedback loops that need to be accounted for. And that's the move into a new level of thought, systems thinking, which shows up really in a big way in postmodern paradigms, where all that's accounted for, and where we start to take systems seriously. And, you know, despite all of their faults and their myriad, people like Foucault, you know, we're getting at this stuff by trying to draw our attention to systems of knowledge and how we are part of systems of knowledge that we get enculturated into and all that. And so all of that helps us, because it brings to our awareness this stuff that had been outside of our understanding before. And when we now have more information that we can incorporate into our model of reality and deal with, we are able to do better science, and we're able to avoid the pitfalls of that linear modernist thinking in a way that they weren't able to. And so, again, this is how the radicalization of modern thought through postmodern thought actually improves upon the modernist thought, because it brings more into the situation. And again, you can see then that that is linked to a way of assessing perspectives in terms of how many perspectives they include, so that you can adjudicate that in many instances, like the ones we're talking about, systems thinking and postmodern insights will be a better perspective to take on something than a simpler modern perspective or something, right? And a better mm-hmm. perspective still than a pre-modern perspective and all this. Now let me try to tie all this into Christianity because yeah. it's interesting.
Can I actually, yeah. I'm going to pause you for a second. Warren. All right. So Brennan, you were just about to tell us about how this applies to Christianity and theology.
Yeah. And not only that, I'll try to come at this through the lens of this corner of the internet, and or this little corner, and what it is that I'm specifically trying to bring to the conversation that I feel like is in danger of being missed, which is that I think folks in this little corner get the postmodern insight, which is to say we can't have this monarchical vision that we're rooted in perspectives and that it's personal and perspectival and participatory, all that stuff that they get from Verveke, like, great, totally true. And then they recognize all this and see that this is a legitimate critique of modernism, and that, yeah, that modernist frame was trying to do this view from nowhere and this monarchical vision. Great. So now we've got an insight of perspectivalism and a critique of modernity that shows that the modernity itself is just another perspective, that the scientific approach is a perspective, right?
Frequentism is a type of Bayesian statistics.
Yeah,
Bayesian statistics incorporates frequentism within it. Yeah.
Now that's kind of the direction I'm heading in. But yeah. The danger is that you misinterpret this insight to allow you to do this thing where you say, all right, well, if we're all just dealing with perspectives and the modern one, you know, just as good as any other, and the postmodern one clearly has lots of flaws, why not just work with a traditional religious, you know, kind of doctrinal literalism, mm-hmm. what have you, of the sort that existed pre-modern scientific interrogation.
Why not just go back and say, all right, everyone has a perspective. I'm just doing this perspective. Thanks for your insight that there are other perspectives. I'm just going to keep perspectiving.
Well, yeah. And I think that there's a danger then in how you apply this, right? And so I think, mm-hmm. yeah, there are many ways that people can just say, all right, well, then I'm just going to hold to my perspective because I am a Christian, and because, you know, I'm not. And again, there's an insight here, and it's an important one. Like, yes, that is something to take very seriously. Like, don't, you know, don't just hop into a different perspective for no reason, because, yeah, that mm-hmm. perspective is important to you and valuable to you and shapes your view of the world and all that. Like, great, cool. But here's the danger, right? Is that this can become a bypass of modern thought, because you get mm-hmm. the postmodern and you grew up in a traditional, or let's say you found a traditional, you know, doxological lens that really works very well and is very meaningful for you and of use. And now you're just going to use the postmodern insight about perspectives to just avoid the modern stuff and just live in the traditional. And yeah. that is what I see people being in danger of. I'm not going to say people are doing that or make that kind of claim mm-hmm. or whatever, but I just, the way that the conversation is unfolding tends in that direction. And right. even
and not to make anyone too angry, but do you feel like the people who are attracted to Orthodoxy or Eastern Orthodoxy, or at least some of the time, are maybe sort of doing an act or a move kind of like that?
I do. And I think it doesn't, I mean, by Orthodoxy, I'm not sure if you mean specifically like Eastern Orthodoxy.
I mean, Eastern Orthodoxy. Yeah, converting yeah. to the Church of Eastern Orthodoxy.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you know, there's that. And I think that, but I would say Orthodoxy is more generally conceived, right? Traditional mm-hmm. Orthodoxies. Because this is the same, you know, issue. So when people watch that conversation that I had with Paul Vanderclay, and we started getting into the issue of the resurrection and physics and or physical versus actual and literal and all that stuff, this was like that was the moment in which we began to grapple with this aspect, which then opened up, I think, something very productive that we're still trying to work through, which is what do we do with these perspectives? Because in many ways, these perspectives are non-modern. They aren't the modern response. I'm not trying to say that they're anything more than that. Just that a modernist, in that modernist lens, and I'm not saying that that's the right lens either, it's just a perspective, but the modernist would say, oh, you know, miracles don't happen and we can't have resurrections of bodies because of natural law and all that stuff that we talked about going back to Galileo, right? So like, that's the modernist lens. And so then the issue is, oh, okay, you're not doing that. So why aren't you doing that? Is it because you get all of that and you just don't think it's a good argument? Is it because you have never actually engaged with any of that? Well, those are two very different things, right? Or is it because maybe you do that sometimes and not in others, right? So there are multiple ways that people then can deal with these different perspectives. And that's what I want to try to introduce as a more viable alternative than the option of just using postmodernism to bypass the modern and live in the orthodox traditional. So what that looks like from my perspective is owning deeply and engaging deeply, integrating deeply that modernist historical critical lens. And that's going to be really, really hard. It was really hard for me. But here's where metamodernism and a metamodern Christianity offers some help, because it's not saying, yeah, we need to give up the traditional Orthodox lens and everyone needs to embrace the modernist lens. No, it's saying we have these lenses. What do we do with them? How do we relate them to each other, right? And so one aspect of this, which is really crucial, is toggling, as I call it, or oscillation, as it's sometimes called, or whatever, there are different terms for this. But we can move through these different perspectives in a context-dependent situation, right? We can inhabit the traditional Orthodox mentality and perspective in ritual, in during the liturgy, and feel that and live in that mode. And then the next day, when someone's talking to us about, you know, well, what's the history of this stuff? You can toggle to the modern historical critical lens and be like, yeah, well, actually, maybe in this case, this thing didn't actually happen in real historical time or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And then you, in another context, can toggle to this issue where these are matters of perspective that the postmodern insight makes us aware of. And especially like if you're sitting around a dinner table and you've got a traditional Orthodox friend and you've got a modern scientific historical critically minded person over here, how are you going to navigate this relationship? Well, maybe you can lean more into the perspectival in that situation and emphasize, this person has this perspective, you know. So Carl, you know, own and appreciate your own perspective and blah, blah, blah. And then you can begin to facilitate the kind of valuable exchange of ideas that might be able to go on here. And the last thing I'll say for now is that there is also the sort of meta vantage here where you can orient all of these different perspectives relative to one another to see how many of them are included, right? So here's where it might become a little bit hard for more Orthodox-minded people to grok what I'm trying to argue, because I am inclined to believe, based on my own experience, that the traditional Orthodox view is often one that is unable to take other perspectives, or at least certain perspectives. And there are many reasons for that. A big reason is that that's usually one that you, a perspective that you gain earlier on when you're first getting your worldview shaped, right? And so that's kind of your only perspective you have to work with. Another reason for that, though, is that maybe someone just never spent time, which is something I'm seeing actually a lot in some of the conversations I'm having. People just aren't familiar with certain things about modern historical critical biblical studies, for example. They're like, wait, what do you mean the Exodus didn't happen? They just never heard that before. And so then it's like you'd have to spend some time in that perspective, right? And then if you do that, the kind of big wager is that one perspective will then be able to have a perspective on the other and the other and the other in such a way that you are able to have an integrated collection of these perspectives in yourself, know when and how to toggle between them, and also see the relative merits of each of them, and also know how, let's say, the perspective with the most perspectives is probably the one that in the last analysis you'd want to work within in trying to adjudicate your biggest sense of what is real and what is actual and what is true. That's all. I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's very interesting. The blind spot of orthodoxy is the usefulness of heresy.
That's a great way to put it.
As the local heretic in this corner of the internet, I can quit. Like, obviously the blind spot of orthodoxy is that heresy is often right.
Well, and I'm dealing with some of that in some of the comments too. You know, people, yeah. I'll post these videos about the modern historical lens, and people will say, you know, this is blasphemy, this is heresy, whatever. And it's like, now, what is that doing that doesn't allow you to see this perspective? And it's not even saying that you have to agree with this, but what would happen if you sat with this perspective a little bit? You know, how might your perspective shift? How might your conception of Christianity change when you're able to move between all of these different things simultaneously? And isn't there something about the Christian message itself that calls us to try to expand our horizons and to move beyond certain kinds of rigid orthodoxy, you know, that, you know, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath, sort of a thing, right? That Jesus' ministry himself, he was always dealing with sort of the religious orthodoxy, that he was pushing people's minds beyond and getting them to see that actually your neighbor isn't your literal neighbor. It's a more broad conceptual, you know, ethical notion of who your neighbor is and all that stuff. So I think you can view Christianity from this very lens.
Yeah. So I think maybe the last topic to turn to is how to interact with history in sort of in light of metamodernism's insights as a Christian. And this is a subject that I've been wrestling with a lot. Like, a big amount of energy on my podcast is going through the church fathers or looking at scripture in the historical context of the New Testament or the history of Christianity in the first couple centuries and trying to, you know, figure out what they think. Some people, like Sherry, sometimes pokes me, I think, sometimes, like, oh, well, you really think you can figure out what these people think? Or, you know, I can't wait till, she said something recently, like, I can't wait till 500 years from now until people try and figure out what people in TLC thought.
Right.
As sort of like she's doing a metamodern prodding. Sure. With that question. And I appreciate that. I'm not trying to criticize Sherry. Mm-hmm. She's right. But yet at the same time, we kind of do need to figure out what these people thought. That is at least part of the exercise.
Exercise. Tell me why, though. I mean, I don't disagree, but why would you say we need to know what they thought?
I think that, like, the weird thing with Christianity now is that, in a way that I think that previous versions of Christianity might not have had to struggle with as much. The older Christianity gets, the further away we are from Jesus, the more history is in between us and Jesus's time. That just by definition. Mm-hmm. And that we need to find a way that is relating to us now, kind of toggling a little bit. We need to have a lens that is how to relate to Jesus now, how to relate to Jesus through the last 2,000 years, and how to relate to Jesus 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is able to do all those things simultaneously, or at least, if not simultaneously, to be able to toggle between them appropriately.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that that's a real challenge. And I think that part of that is trying to do your best to be able to build the lenses of Christians from the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what, you know, I had a recent episode with Father Stephen DeYoung, the host of the Laura Spears podcast, and we are arguing a lot about what Athanasius thought about images and icons.
Mm.
And we spent over an hour talking about what Athanasius thought about images and icons.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so why do we need to care about that? Mm-hmm. But it's like we need to have a relationship to history that is somehow authentic and congruent with the way that we're using it, or something like that.
Yeah.
And to me, I'm sort of poking the Orthodox. I'm like, you guys think Athanasius is this like super duty saint, and yet he seems to disagree with you about one of your doctrines, and that seems like a problem for you. Okay, but I don't just mean to poke them, because I also need to deal with Athanasius. And as a non-Trinitarian, that makes me extra, I need to deal with him in perhaps a slightly different way. But I still need to deal with Athanasius, because he has affected the environment that I'm in, at least in some sense. And so I don't know. I don't have a final answer for this, so I'm hoping you can help me out.
Well, I'm not going to claim that I do have the final answer. I have an answer. I have a perspective on this topic. And I feel like this has been great because people, I think, watching this will now have a sense of the questions around a metamodern Christianity. And then it's a matter of how do you answer those questions. And I think that we can very meaningfully answer those questions in ways that very meaningfully disagree with each other and yet still be doing something called metamodern Christianity. So I don't want to suggest that my answer is the answer on that topic, but I do think that some ways of framing what we think of metamodern Christianity is much closer to what that would actually be versus other ways that people might want to use that phrase. I'll say that. My answer to that, though, is to kind of flip the script, and it's to say we're inclined to, as you say, see history as this thing that's distancing us more and more from Jesus. I want to say the historical Jesus, that's true in a way. But I would suggest that we look instead to the direction that we're headed as moving us closer and closer to the Christ of faith. As that what has been unfolding as perspectives have gained on perspectives and we've gained more understanding of our understanding and reality itself and that sort of a thing and the problems that come from trying to understand and we've unfolded the question and the problem space further in a profound way. And that doesn't mean we've come to hard and fast truths necessarily, but even having a better understanding of what the problem is an advance in our learning than when we didn't see what else was involved. And I do think that over time, let's just say in the last 2,000 years since Jesus, we have been advancing in our appreciation of all of that and in taking in more taking in more about reality, more information, and trying to make our account based on all of that. Now, I would say that if Christ represents or speaks to or is the fullness of being and ultimate reality, whatever language you want to use for that, then I would say we are moving closer towards that. We're moving in the direction of that, not further away from it. So maybe ironically, yes, we're moving further from the historical Jesus, but we're moving closer to Christ, so conceived. And that I would invite people to try to think in those terms because then it's not a matter of retroactively trying to reconstruct the right answer that somehow existed in the past and help and holds true for all time. That it's a matter of looking to the future and seeing how reality is continuing to unfold and be revealed to us, and how we are deepening our relationship with that reality in such a way that is drawing us closer to the reality of Christ, I would say. And so within that framing, history doesn't have to serve as that thing that is the profound source of anxiety that it sometimes is in Christianity, of like, you know, if tomorrow, for example, this was a huge thing that actually that came up for me, right? I don't know if you've ever heard of the Talpiot tomb. It's this yeah, okay, so it's this collection of ossuaries, or like which were what held the bones of people back in the day, kind of like coffins basically, and families would maybe have their own sort of tomb where they would put the bones of people, that sort of a thing. So they discovered some years ago this collection of ossuaries of the bone fragments of a family that had names like James, Jesus, Mary, Joseph. I think I encourage people to look into this, right? So to find all the details. And even today, you know, pretty notable biblical scholars, I think James Tabor, he even says, yeah. And the takeaway would be, these are the bones of Jesus, the historical person. When I learned about this and I was a teenager, this was devastating. I mean, it provoked an existential crisis. Now, here's my point that I would want to make. And for the record, people listening, I kind of side with the consensus in scholarship that this probably has nothing to do with the historical Jesus. So but if you felt yourself breathing a sigh of relief, reflect on that. Because the point is, I think that for many Christians still, there's this notion that one historical archaeological find could undermine their entire faith. And I think a metamodern Christianity says, no, that's not how you have to think about this at all. They could find the bones of Jesus tomorrow and prove it with whatever means we could prove it, and you could still be a viable active, believing, devotional Christian, because you're oriented to the Christ of faith, you're not oriented towards whatever might have happened or not happened 2,000 years
and
ago.
You see, I'm not so sure if that distinction will quite work.
We can talk about
like that. What if I told you that we found something in the archives of Washington, D.C. that turned out that Hitler was a proto-CIA plant, right? That had been being operated by FDR the whole time, and that he was an FDR puppet. And that it was really so that America could get, you know, greater leverage over Western Europe or something like that.
Yeah.
And that the U.S. had manufactured Hitler this whole time. Would that change your faith in the U.S. government or something like that?
In the government? Like, sure. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
No.
Go on. And so history does matter.
Yes.
And that I think that as Christians, we do need to be open to the facts of history shaping us.
I totally agree. And believe me, don't think I'm saying that history doesn't matter, because obviously most of what I've been putting out lately is to just bring the history to this whole conversation. What I am trying to say, though, well, there's two points I would make. One is, you know, governments are historical, let's say, historically rooted, historically grounded. Like the value of governments is in their historical, factual, how they play out. But governments and religion are doing two different things and speaking to two different functions in the human psyche. You know, like, yes, it does matter if, like, secretly you're stealing my money this whole time, and then I don't want you to be my accountant, right? But if you're my priest and you're trying to help me make sense of reality and move me greater towards truth and flourishing and alignment and all of that, then it's a different issue, right? It's in the matter of being oriented towards all of that kind of, well, meaning, right? Essentially. And another thing I will say, though, is that I'm not saying it doesn't matter, because I think actually there is a very meaningful way that when we do integrate the insights of history, we should become really skeptical of institutions. We should realize that, oh yeah, things aren't what they seem a lot of the time, and we were wrong about a lot of things, and some things that we really cared about actually didn't happen and all that. And that is freeing, right? It might be disappointing at first, but it's that sort of thing that opens you then to be looser with your engagement with this material. It's not like, what did Athanasius think? Because once we really know what he really said, then we'll have the answer. And so we'll just spend all this time and energy. And like, it's like, well, maybe it doesn't really matter what he thought. Maybe if we actually knew what he really thought, it would be kind of disappointing. And so that's not really the value that he serves. What the value that he might serve is that the way he thinks, or that we think he thought, might be of value for how we think in the present moment, not what he said however many years ago. And in fact, and here's kind of the radical idea, is that the gospel could become more true in the future than it is in the past, if that makes any sense, right? Mm-hmm. That like that the message of Jesus could be expanded in such a way that 200 years from now, people will be living better Christian lives, more flourishing in relationship to the gospel than they were in the early church. Okay. And that's what I mean, because it's not about those, it's not about that context. It's about the ideas and the images and the conceptions, the insight about the nature of reality. And that is still unfolding. And if we can link our conception of Christ to that, which I think theologically minded folks should and have a history of doing so, then that can orient us towards Christ. Rather than, you know, what may or may not have happened. I don't know.
I'm still trying to figure out what restorationism looks like kind of in this sort of TLC metamodern space, because I'm probably more of an advocate for restorationism than most folks, and still have a little bit of faith in that project, and still kind of feel like, well, I do kind of care what Athanasius thought about icons in some sense, but I it's tricky, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying about, you know, Jesus isn't just in the past, he's in the present. But I, you know, it is notable that even when I was talking, I didn't mention that Jesus is also in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that these things do need to cohere a little bit. And I'm suspicious of, well, Jesus in the future is more important than Jesus in the past or something.
Sure.
Or and that I'm wary that that could be used. I suppose really my fear is I'm wary that that could be used in ways that are agenda seeking in a way that is not faithful to Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose my main experience of thinking that is as my non-Trinitarian background, when I, you know, get attacked by the Trinitarians and I do my thing like, hey, the early Christians didn't believe in the Trinity and it doesn't seem like Jesus did either. Why are you hitting me with this stuff? And they're like, well, development, well, the church grew in its understanding. Mm. Well, you know, as we've grown into the fullness of the truth, Trinity, 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 and you just clearly haven't grown enough in your, you know, knowingness of the truth. Uh-huh. I'm like, hey, I'm trying to be loyal to this Jesus guy.
Yeah.
Isn't that what you're trying to do too? And like, what's the stuff, like, what makes you so sure that you're the one who grown to the fullness of the truth and that it's not me?
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. And so it's that experience when I'm like, anytime I hear people starting to separate Christ to faith and Christ to history too much. I know that experience is part of what makes me a little queasy about that.
No, that's good. I totally hear that. I totally hear that. And I mean, for the record, in support of your cause, though, you know, this is maybe like, you know, strange bedfellows, because I don't know if you'll want my support in your cause. It might hurt your cause. But I would think that historically speaking, Jesus didn't have a conception of the Trinity. But we can explore that some other time.
Anyone seeking after the truth is in support of my cause, because I hope that my cause is nothing other than that. But
yeah. I will say this, though. So I very much understand that. But a lot of my thinking around this issue is born out of the experience of having spent so much time trying to get back to that Jesus of history. Yeah. And the really profoundly disturbing thing, which I think has to be, will always be a kind of scandal for people as they explore these materials, is that the Jesus of history, through the modernist lens, let's just say, what that lens gives us is not who we think of even in our own religious lives relating to Jesus. I mean, if you're talking about what did he believe, right? And you want to explore that from a historical lens, it's a profoundly, disillusioning, because when you spend time with this material in this way, in applying that methodology and seeing the arguments and having each of these precious ideas of yours sort of chipped away at because they're so valuable, but like, oh no, gotta let that one go because it's just not the case. You end up with a vision of the Jesus of history that I don't know if there, how do I say this? I want to be careful, obviously, with my words here, but like, maybe after doing that work, it's not that figure who speaks to your soul. And maybe that is therefore,
or the process of doing that work shapes your soul in a way that's not what you want.
And that's also true as well.
It's not like the most, faithful Christian in history is an archaeologist.
Right. And there's reasons for that, right?
Right.
It's also, you know, I think another way you could look at this, though, is that I've known many doctors, and a lot of them tend towards depression. Because once you start opening bodies up and seeing the meat that we're made out of, that's a very dispiriting and disillusioning experience. And the way that that can then impact how you look at other living people is rather disturbing. And so it's certainly the case that the, you know, what we set our minds to shapes us, and the kinds of questions that we ask wind up influencing the sorts of answers that we find. And all those are postmodern insights that are true and real, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't realize the significance that when you do actually do this, it leads you in a particular direction, even though we can still own the postmodern takeaway of, well, then let's be loose with the kinds of perspectives that we're inhabiting, right? Because the mistake that I made, and I think people still make, is that it's this either or thing. It's like, well, if you study the history, you're going to lose your faith, or you're going to get into these, you know, mm-hmm. historical approaches mm-hmm. that are just going to sap your devotional, you know, care and all this stuff. And that then it's sort of like, if you explore this stuff, you're going to lose your faith. as a kind of natural result. And I don't think that's true at all if you have a metamodern perspective on it all, which is I can know all the history and I can get that picture and I can think that that's historically true. Like I can actually think that that's what happened. And I can still go to church or whatever feast or festival or whatever, take part in whatever liturgy, and I can still do that. And I can still relate to this other figure that isn't in that lens. And whether you conceive of that as now you're toggling back to a traditional devotional lens, whether you conceive of that as there's a plurality of perspectives that are contextually relevant in different ways for us, however you want to conceive of that, that's the metamodern Christianity I want to offer people as an option, because some people are going to need that. Some people are going to have studied this stuff and they're going to think there's no way I could ever be a Christian again after knowing what I know. And, and there will be people who would say, I just wish I could be a Christian, but I can't now knowing what I know. And I think that a metamodern Christianity allows people to say, yeah, well then be a Christian, like own that perspective as a perspective, include it in your perspectives, but that's not the only perspective. And it's not the only one that needs to dominate your sense of reality. And a metamodern approach to this issue, I think, could really help.
Yeah. And one thing I worry about, and this is something interesting that I've seen, because I've talked to a lot of scholars, biblical scholars, on my channel, and there are Christian biblical scholars who have a pretty strong divide, honestly,
sure,
between their faith life and their academic life.
Yeah,
even though they're biblical scholars or New Testament scholars or early Christianity scholars or something along those lines. And it's like, well, here are the things that I think the Bible's saying in its original context or something, or what I think Paul meant. And here's what I faith-wise choose to sort of believe that it means.
Yeah.
And I know a fair amount of folks who do that. They often tend to be on the liberal end of the spectrum, but maybe not always. And I worry that there's a certain dividedness in that that is not quite the sort of reconciliation of all forms of truth that I feel like metamodernism is hoping for. And that it, not like schizophrenic is too strong of a word, but it's a little bit over here, I think this. When I'm at my desk during the week, I think this. When I'm in church on Sunday, I think this.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm not quite sure if that's what we're after.
I hear that. And I think that's right. So that's why I personally don't tend in the direction of interpreting it fully that way, because I think it's too much cognitive dissonance to just like live these different modes. So personally, I tend much more in the direction of synthesis, of being able to appreciate that all of these perspectives are part of an unfolding sequence of insights. And you can even relate this to progressive revelation, what have you, but that our understanding of God is evolving. And some of the moments of that evolving insight are actually moments of doubt and maybe even disbelief. We also, I think, have to grapple with the negation of faith to know what faith is, right? We have to grapple with, maybe this Jesus figure isn't who I thought he was and all that. And I think that there's something very profoundly beautiful by seeing the sequence of perspectives, however you want to map this, sequence of perspectives or sequence of perspectives, as an unfolding revelation about our relationship with the divine that has moments to it and that we experience as important sort of stations of the cross, you could almost say, these important contributions to that relationship, in the same way that your relationship with any person goes through these sorts of moments. Like when you were a kid, you thought your parents were God, essentially, that they were just perfect. And then you go through that loss of innocence where you're like, oh, my dad, he lied, you know, ouch, you know, like, oh, then you have to like grapple with that. But then you gain a deeper understanding of who your dad is, right? And then you're like, oh, okay. And then on the other side of, you know, whatever these moments are, puberty is the same kind of thing. It's like, oh God, that sucks. But hey, there are some really nice things on the other side of that that you don't get before it. So it's like the growth and the transformation and the development can experience these falls or these struggles that are really challenging to work through. But when they get enfolded and integrated into a much more complex perspective on the issue, I think then you're able to relate to Christ in a way that is much more full, anti-fragile, robust, and mysterious too. And also one that orients you in a new direction while also being more and more open to more and more perspectives, which I think, again, the best of the Christian message is pointing us to. It's like, how do we welcome in the sinner and the tax collector, and the prostitute? How do we all sit at table and feast together and wash each other's feet? And the people who don't get it are the religious Orthodox people outside the door who are like, you're not supposed to do that. You have too open a perspective. It's like, well, that's what Jesus, I think, was pointing us to. And I think that we can imagine that message extending into the future and becoming more and more open. So that's how I think about it. And therefore, I'm able to welcome the future potential deconstructions of my own current thought as an ongoing learning process that we're all a part of.
Yeah. I think that is a healthy perspective. So I should wrap this up pretty soon, but I'll pass it back to you. Do you have any sort of closing thoughts or any last ideas that you want to get off your chest?
Let me think. The first thing I'll say is that this was so great. I'm really glad. I feel like this was an opportunity to say a little bit more where I'm really coming from. I've been putting out all these videos into this space since this TLC engagement thing. And some people are resonating with that, and a lot of people aren't. I mean, actually, that I posted one video on this whole issue of miracles and the historical Jesus, and that got by far, like, people just hated that. So I get that there's all this pushback, and believe me, I understand why. And if I would have heard my current self talking back when I was 15 years old or 16, I would have been like, this guy's dangerous, shut this guy down or whatever, he's just, or, oh, isn't he sad? He has this perspective, and but he's a lost soul. And those with ears to hear. Whenever anyone says those with ears to hear, I'm kind of like, I take that with a little grain of salt. Because, well, anyway. So, yeah, I guess I would just say thank you for this opportunity to get into this stuff more and begin to unpack all this a bit more. I'm happy to talk to people for whom this resonates. All this does come out of my experience of having grappled so difficultly with these issues that it's not a matter of, oh, I read some books on the historical Jesus and now, it's like, no, like the crisis I underwent and the depths of dark night of the soul that this really brought out, I can really sympathize with. And so I'm not trying to antagonize or poke people or you're all just stupid if you don't do this, if you don't just give up on the historical Jesus. It's like, no, like, I really get it. I just want to make that point. And I guess maybe just to add to that, despite, as I've already said, that this maybe won't be the right answer, that there could be better approaches to this, but also that this could be just what some folks really think is what they need and that they're looking for. Just, they're like, oh my gosh, I actually can do all of these things. And I can keep believing, quote unquote, but with a big asterisk in terms of what that means now and trying to incorporate and include all of this. So I'll say all that. And then I guess the last thing I'll say, by hinting towards an even more radical heresy in all of this, I guess, is that I think, Luther proposed the idea of this sort of priesthood of all believers, right? I think that we can even go further and should with a sort of prophetic guild of all believers, that once you understand that God is unfolding in human history and our understanding is growing and that works by means of the Athanasiuses of the world and the Luthers of the world, but also the Teilhard de Chardins of the world and the Brian McLarens of the world and what have you, that I think we have to appreciate that we are the body of Christ, meaning we are helping to unfold the next levels and layers to that deepening conception of the divine, and that we are therefore in a kind of prophetic vocation to help God continue to become clearer and more manifest to people through an opening and an including of more perspectives and a folding in of more contradictions. And that is one of deconstruction and grappling, but it's also this reconstructive process that we can participate in a way that I find to be incredibly beautiful and meaningful. And I think that, yeah, this conversation and those like it are a part of that sort of process. So Yeah, I guess that would be one of the last things I would throw in.
That sounds great. If there's anything that TLC seems to actually believe in, that everyone seems to actually believe in, it's that good faith conversations are never a bad thing, and that it is the way to unite multiple perspectives in the pursuit of the truth.
Yeah.
And other than that, I don't know what else we agree about.
Well, I would say one last thing on that front, which is that that's a very Christian. I hope that we can say that that's a very Christian perspective. And I think we can also grapple with the difficulties of looking back in the Christian past and seeing that Christian perspective not yet operationalized, not yet occurring, right? And unfortunately, even with a lot of those, early church councils and stuff, like literally the way a lot of creeds got settled was who can raise a bigger mob and burn down some building? And it's like, so yeah, progressive.
Athanasius was quite good at raising mobs and burning down his opponents'
Hey,
buildings.
not to go after your boy, but Athanasius has the dark side too. So, but yeah, so I if we can lean into that and see the Christ in the Christian discourse around good faith, open, long form conversations, let's find more where that came from and deepen into our understanding of that Christ, because I think that's the right direction.
All right, Brendan Graham Dempsey, thank you very much. This was
Thank
very
you.
enjoyable.